This is episode 5 of the Performance Dietitian Podcast. I'm Susan Lopez, and today Jenna Stedman is going to be joining us. Jenna is the tactical dietitian for the Indiana National Guard, and she is working with the Army's new Holistic Health and Fitness, or H2F, initiative. We are going to talk about the H2F program and Jenna's non-traditional route into military nutrition today. So I hope you enjoy today's episode. I'm Susan Lopez, and today I have with me Jenna, H2F dietitian out of Illinois. And if you haven't heard of H2F, H2F is the Army's new initiative. It's the Holistic Health and Fitness Program. And we're going to be talking about that today because it's new and it's interesting and it's really kind of a non-traditional dietitian area. And that's why Jenna's with us today. She's going to be kind of talking about her experience. So Jenna, welcome.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit about just your background. So where you went to school at, where you did internship, and what kind of led you to where you are now. And tell us a little bit about what you do now.
Sure. So I think I was sort of non-traditional right from the start. I had originally gone to Northeastern in Boston, and I wanted to major in rowing. So I was really excited about the sports program there. I was not very interested in school. I picked environmental science as my major because I really liked it, but I didn't really have a career picked out. You know, I didn't really have an idea as to what I wanted to do. And while I was there, I happened to, you know, be placed in a nutrition class, and it was like everything finally like started clicking for me. And I really started to figure out like, hey, this is something that I actually enjoy and I can make a career with it. And you know, growing up with parents who, you know, always had health and nutrition in mind, it's just started to really make sense to me that, you know, the more I was learning about nutrition, the better I was eating, the better I was performing. So that was really my first kind of interest in sports nutrition. But after my freshman year, I did end up transferring to the University of New Hampshire, which is the state I'm originally from. And so I did, I switched my major. So I did finish my undergrad with my BS in dietetics, which is what we have to do. I didn't immediately apply for the dietetic internship. I took a little break to save up some money for the internship. I did go and do my master's online while I was trying to save a little bit of money and help myself get into the internship. So I did my master's in nutrition and human performance. So a little bit of sports nutrition there. And I did that through Logan University, which was a fabulous program. I will recommend that for everyone. If anyone's looking for a great online master's program, they should probably start looking there first. And then I did my internship as a distance program, which I think are relatively new in dietetics, are the distance programs. So it was the Gulf Coast distance dietetic internship, which was out of Mississippi. It was very cool. So I got to go there for a week to do our little orientation. But then I actually got to stay home in New Hampshire, or you know, New Hampshire, Vermont area. And I did my entire dietetic internship through the White River Junction VA hospital, which was mostly luck that I found such a great program, which was amazing. But it really was probably the best learning experience out of all my years of practice so far.
Yeah, the distance internship, I think you're right. That's pretty new. I think when I was going through internship, your only options were on-site. I did have a distance option, but it was still kind of local to where the on-site program was. So for you to be so far away from your actual internship school, that's really interesting.
It was very weird. It was a lot of emails, a lot of phone calls. We were each assigned an advisor, essentially, out of the program. And it was a lot of daily and weekly communication, making sure we were, you know, getting everything done and meeting all of the requirements. Mm-hmm. So,
So, and now you're working with the H2F program, which, like I said earlier, is the Army's new health initiative, the Holistic Health and Fitness Program. So now you're working with that program with the National Guard in Illinois, right?
In Indiana, yes.
Indiana, sorry.
Yeah,
So
that's okay.
I keep thinking you're in Illinois for some reason. So tell us a little bit about how you got into that and what that looks like for you right now.
I guess I had originally been interested in kind of military dietetics was because I had done my internship at the VA and I just had such a wonderful experience there. I had actually originally started looking at jobs at other VA hospitals because unfortunately the White River Junction one was fully staffed and so they could not hire me. I would have loved to join them, but they had no more spots. So I had started looking at other VA hospitals and someone had mentioned, like, hey, Army and Air Force bases will actually hire dietitians for you to work right, on site there. So I started looking at, some different jobs there. And I think it was sort of a tricky thing because I didn't really understand how the contracting piece of it worked. But I had applied for three different jobs. There was, I think, like an assistant dietitian in Fort Drum, and then there was one at like Nellis Air Force Base out in Nevada. But I think they had to like win the contract for me to actually get hired or something like that. So I'm not actually sure how that, but neither of those had worked out. And then I found this program at the Indiana National Guard, which I wasn't expecting a National Guard base or program to be hiring a full-time dietitian. But when I interviewed, everyone was really nice and really friendly, and it seems like they had a pretty good start to their program, and there was still a lot of work to do there. So I took a leap and I moved to Indiana.
So that's super interesting. So I actually work with the H2F program on the active Army side. So I know we're going to kind of talk a little bit about that today. Now, my kind of coming up through that was a little bit different. So I actually was in the military for 7 years, right out of high school. And I was working as what's known as a 68 Mike, which is a nutrition care specialist in the Army. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the MOSs that the Army offers.
No, I'm still sort of learning.
and I know the options are a little bit different when you're working with a National Guard unit because you're not going to have as many, of course, individuals there as you would on an active military base. So 68 Mike is like a nutrition care specialist. And essentially what they do is they send you to military cook school. So I learned how to cook for the military.
That's
And
so
then,
cool.
yeah, well, it was long hours. I don't know if you've ever worked in food service, but it's like you're up before the sun comes up, and then sometimes you're there after the sun goes down. So it's just, it can be intense. And then I did an additional block of training after that to actually learn nutrition, calories, macronutrients, texture modifications, different disease states, that kind of thing. So I did that with the military. And then I got out, excuse me. And then I separated from the military in 2007. And I went to school at the University of Houston down in Texas to get my dietetics undergraduate degree. The internship that I did, it was a distance internship. It was only 6 months long. How long was yours?
Oh, that's very cool. I think ours could have been six. I sort of weird. I think it could have been 6 months long because they will allow prior learning experience, what they're calling, to count for part of the internship. So like I had like a 3 year gap basically between my between school and my internship. So I had a couple different work experiences that counted. So I think I had finished mine in maybe 7 months. I think
Okay.
it's more typical that people are taking like 8, 9, or 10 months. But it also it depends on kind of how many hours you're able to work. I know some of the interns, other interns in my program, I know, could only find some part-time clinical work or things like that, and so they had to try to balance different schedules. And then others, were happy to kind of like just plow through the program and work, 24/7 and get it done.
Okay, gotcha. So yeah. So with that internship through the University of Houston, the distance one, it was about 6 months. And the expectation was that you were going to work about 45 to 50 hours a week in that internship in order to finish within the time frame that they had. So that was really interesting. So I worked a lot during the week, and then I actually worked at the VA hospital every weekend. So I would do like 10-hour shifts on Saturday and Sunday at the VA hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, as a phlebotomist, actually, because I had prior training in that. So that whole 6 months was just like chaotic. So,
yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, but I chose that internship because I also, at that time, I was a little bit older. So I was actually, 26 or 27 when I went into the program. And I actually graduated when I was 30. I had just turned 30. Yeah. So, and I already was married and like had kids. So I was like, you know, I really don't have time to do an 18-month master's program.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So I really had put all my eggs in that basket and kept my fingers crossed. And fortunately I got it. That's how I did my internship. I also didn't necessarily want to get my master's in nutrition. I wanted to look more at getting my master's in some type of exercise science, because that was always something that it interested me as well. So kind of like you. So I didn't have my master's program once I started working as a dietitian. Started working as a dietitian, worked in wellness pretty much the entire time. The last couple of years before I went to the H2F program, I worked in clinical management. So I oversaw a couple of different hospital nutrition programs. And then I started working for the H2F program around the same time you did, in September of 2019 of last year.
Yeah.
So we've kind of been doing it, it sounds like, on the same timeline, just in different settings.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the H2F program's pretty new. I think it initially started late 2018, maybe.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so brand new. But anyway, so that's where I'm at. So I actually lived in Houston, Texas as a dietitian. And then when the job became available here in Washington State, I loaded up my kids, my dogs, put everything in a trailer, and we moved 2,500 miles so I could take on this new position.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, I will tell you that I am married to an active duty soldier, so we were also able to get him stationed out here. So.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So it worked out smoothly. I moved before he moved. So I was here in Washington for probably 4 months before he actually got here.
Yeah. That's not too bad.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up in the H2F program. Yeah. So now, tell us a little bit about your experiences working with the National Guard. You know, coming from a non-military background, transitioning into military nutrition, what's that been like for you?
I actually kind of think that the National Guard was kind of a nice, I don't want to say stepping stone because that makes it think like I'm leaving tomorrow, but it made it seem like kind of a nice transition a little bit, because you know they're soldiers for 2 days every month, and for you know the rest of the 28-29 days of that month they really are civilians. They have civilian jobs, they're working, you know, some of them have 9-to-5 jobs, some of them are working different shifts, and so in that sense I'm really working, you know, with a very kind of similar population to, you know, who I was working with at the VA hospitals. Really, I don't know, kind of regular people, and then they have this little side of military life, which is very cool. So it's nice for me because, you know, military has a lot of acronyms and a lot of different terms, a lot of things that I'm trying to learn very quickly, you know, without having a military background. So that part has been, a very, very cool learning experience for me. The other kind of funny piece of it was, I, you know, showed up my first day at work in Indiana, and they said, okay, here's your office, go be a dietitian. And there was, you know, we're still trying to piece together a lot of these different resources about like what other H2F dietitians have done in other states, and really where we can kind of shape our program and focus it in the best way for the soldiers that we have. And so I'm still trying to kind of collect a lot of those different resources and figure out what to do.
Okay. So other than now that we've met and we have this connection, have you had the opportunity to talk to any other H2F dietitians about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
it's really unique, right? Because we're really spread out.
Oh, yeah.
And I can tell you, like, on the active duty side, even though I have, I think, 4 other contract dietitians that are kind of on the same footprint, we still really are very separated. So on the active duty side, in my battalion, it's me. I have 2 strength coaches that I work with. An athletic trainer, and then a physical therapist. And that's what the setup looks like on my side. And we're kind of all in our own little bubble. So sometimes we're all doing different things as far as each group, because the culture in every individual unit is so different. Some people respond really well to the program. Others are still kind of standoffish towards it, just because it's so different from what the Army's done for the last 40 years. As far as you, you know, being able to reach out to other H2F dietitians, how have you gone about doing that?
I sort of did like the creepy thing of going on LinkedIn and just like searching H2F dietitian or Army dietitian, like seeing kind of who pops up. And I've been sort of trying to like message people and be like, hey, what have you done when this occurred? Or what do you do when a soldier tells you this? And so some people have been very nice and understanding that, you know, I'm brand new. And they've been very helpful. They'll write back and they'll give me different advice. Other people, I think, maybe just don't check LinkedIn or don't know who I am, so they're not going to write back. But it really has been this sort of like just blindly like, asking questions to anyone I can find.
So just to reassure you, I do the same thing.
I did the first time I started kind of doing that a little bit. I felt like someone's going to find like this is going to be weird. So
yeah, I think sometimes you just, you know, that's what those platforms are for. Sometimes like the LinkedIn is really to network from a distance. So,
oh yeah.
So it can be kind of scary at first because you don't want them to think that you're just a complete loony case. But I've met so many other dietitians and built relationships with them just kind of using those platforms to connect with them in a non-creepy way.
Right. Oh, yeah. And I think it's also just a little bit of my own personality. Like, I have a very hard time asking questions sometimes because I don't want to come off as, like, not knowing every single answer. And I think that may be a little bit more of, like, you know, the typical kind of like type A dietitian is just like, we want to know everything.
Yeah.
So sometimes I do sort of have that trouble asking the right questions. I would rather just go figure it out on my own. And this job especially has really taught me that you just have to ask the questions. Sometimes you have to find, you know, there are so many experts, there's so many fantastic dietitians out there. And I would say 99% of them want to help and they want to be able to answer those questions for everyone else.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. So I would say for anybody listening, if you have questions, don't be afraid to reach
questions.
Out. Yes, always ask. Because it's better to ask questions, I think, and get the most appropriate answer from somebody who's maybe been there rather than spinning your wheels and potentially giving bad advice. So.
Oh, yeah.
So network, network, network. So what are some maybe barriers or challenges that you've had? I know sometimes from my end, like the culture is a little bit different. So we can kind of talk about that. Because the soldiers I work with, I mean, they're soldiers 24/7.
Yeah.
And the military has a long history of sometimes being more sledgehammer about things than being... you know, more evidence-based driven, we'll say.
Yes.
And so now they're moving away from that, right? So now they're trying to do things smarter. They're trying to be more proactive about keeping soldiers healthy. A lot of soldiers, you know, they run on nicotine and caffeine and cuss words. And that's it. And when it comes to physical training and lifestyle and health, you know, the answer for a long time has really just been beat them into the ground and give them water to drink and they'll be fine. You know, so I think it's really important and I think it's really great that the military is starting to move away from that and starting to do things smarter. But there's definitely that old school mentality that still makes it difficult sometimes to tell soldiers, hey, you need to sleep adequately. You know, most of the soldiers that I work with, if they get more than 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night, you know, then that's a big deal. You know, I'm like, that's great. You're doing better than 90% of the people that I talk to. You know, some of the other barriers that I run into is just not eating at all. They have a tendency to show up for PT in the morning on an empty stomach.
Yeah, I see that too. It amazes me. Like, I can't go into a workout without having like some significant food in my body. And these guys, they show up in the morning and they hadn't eaten anything. That's amazing.
Yeah, you know, they'll sit in their car and drink a coffee or a Bang and smoke a cigarette, you know, and then go out and, you know, run 4 miles, and then they don't eat breakfast after they train, and they might eat lunch. And if they do eat lunch, you know, it might be Burger King. It kind of sounds like even though you're working with the National Guard, you have a lot of the same barriers. So can you talk to us maybe a little bit about some of those challenges?
Oh yeah, I think the two biggest ones that come to mind, besides the not eating, I do see that a lot too. We just did like a mock ACFT test because we've been sort of running through those every so often to see how numbers are improving, which they are, which is very cool.
Yes.
But again, you know, I'm sort of standing around because, you know, I'm not rating this or doing anything, and I'm asking all these guys like, you know, what did you eat before you got here? What are you going to eat after? So they're still learning that like I'm the dietitian.
Yeah, so
And they're
same,
understanding,
yeah.
they're telling me like, oh, nothing. Like I had an energy drink or something. But
Yeah.
yeah, the two biggest ones that probably come to mind are probably the energy drinks. I've really had to, that's a big piece of a lot of the education that I'm doing is I'm trying to teach them as much as I can. Your body doesn't need an energy drink, you don't need more caffeine, you need a carbohydrate. Like
Yeah.
that's our primary energy source. Your body's hungry, that's why it feels tired. Like you need to be eating.
Yeah, absolutely. I went out to one of our diagnostic ACFTs a few weeks ago, and a lot of them didn't even have water out there with them. Yeah, I think they're so used to, you know, when you take the current test, the APFT, you know, it doesn't necessarily take that long, right? So the current PT test is like push up, sit up, 2 mile run, boom, you're done, like in an hour and a half max. Right, just depending on how big your group is. And with us, the ACFT, as we've been doing diagnostic tests, even though it's only supposed to be 90 minutes, we're finding that because of the size of the groups that are going out and testing, it's closer to like 2.5 hours,
Oh, wow.
even when we have the prescribed amount of lanes.
Yeah.
You know, there's only supposed to be like 5 minutes in between each event. And a lot of times, because of the amount of people in the lanes, we're finding that it's taking, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes between events to get through everybody. So you have these guys out there, they haven't eaten anything in the last, you know, 10 to 14 hours, and now they're trying to do these events, right? So now we're getting away from the push-up, the sit-up, the 2 mile run, and now we're doing 3 rep max deadlifts, right? We're doing standing power throws. We're doing the sprint drag carry, you know, which by the time they finish the sprint drag carry, their whole body is on fire.
Oh yeah, they're done. They're totally gassed. Like tanks are empty.
Yeah, absolutely. So if they weren't empty before, they're definitely empty after that. And then you
Yeah.
have, you know, the hand release push-up, which is a lot of people think that they don't have to train for it because they max out regular push-ups. And then they get to that hand release push-up and they realize just how much more difficult it is. So that's another thing we've come across. And then you have the leg tuck, which is proven difficult for a lot of our soldiers because they just sometimes lack the upper body strength and the trunk strength to really get their body into that position. And then the 2 mile run, right? So you're going from 3 events to 6 events, and then the 2 mile run is the last event, but you've already smoked your legs.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You go into it with a completely empty gas tank. So it's been an eye-opener for a lot of soldiers, and it sounds like we're having a lot of the same issues.
Oh, yeah.
Regardless.
They are, I think, as we've been, at least our H2F team, so we have me, dietitian, and then we have an athletic trainer, and we have 3 strength and conditioning coaches, or mm-hmm. strength and conditioning specialists, and we're looking for our PT at OT. They're going to be joining us soon, hopefully. We desperately need our PT. If anyone wants a PT job, we are hiring. but what our team has been looking at, so we've been primarily working with the 293rd. And as they've been going through different testing every so often, what we found is they're really starting to learn really how to pace themselves through that,
mm-hmm.
Which is certainly helping. You know, our test scores are definitely going up. They're definitely getting better, but we're still seeing, you know, we still see those same people come through and think that, you know, it's just another regular PT test when it's not quite.
Yeah. There's been a lot of rude awakenings for sure on my team, but just like you said, we've seen a lot of good results as their scores continue to improve. The more we do the ACFT and also with the type of training that we're doing at PT. So PT, you know, the Army had this thing called physical readiness training,
mm-hmm.
and they still have it. The big Army still does it. A lot of, you know, active National Guard and Reserve units, I'm sure, still participate in physical readiness training. And now what we're seeing with the strength and conditioning coaches doing towards the ACFT, it's really made a difference. The soldiers like it a lot because there's more weightlifting actually involved with the program. You know, and a lot of these guys are guys that like to go in the gym and bang weights and do max lifts anyway. So a lot of the soldiers that I work with really like the new training style, the new program, the new PT test. Are you getting kind of the same vibe from the guys that you work with, the guys and ladies that you work with, or the soldiers that you work with?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, there's always going to be, you know, some people who are just not on board. You know, change is hard. I understand that. But I think for the most part, you know, people are, I'd have to agree. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about some of the application of nutrition that you're doing with the soldiers. So we talked about the barriers, you know, the not eating, you know, the excessive caffeine, nicotine, sometimes alcohol use within the military population, the lack of sleep. There's a lot of stress too amongst the military population that's kind of unique. Like on my, on the active duty side, you know, they're on call 24/7. I get soldiers who come in and a lot of times they pull 24-hour duty on a regular basis. You know, sometimes they'll have details that will be anywhere between 12 to 24 hours long. You know, they get pulled out into field training exercises that can be anywhere from 7 days to 30 days long. Sometimes they're nearby. Sometimes they have to travel to different states to perform those trainings. So those are some of the things that I deal with. Talk about maybe some of the nutrition things and lifestyle things that you've applied to some of your one-on-ones with soldiers that is maybe unique to that situation.
Oh, yeah. So definitely something I've sort of stolen from the Army is the Go for Green mm-hmm. initiative, which we hadn't quite started in the National Guard just yet. And so I had sort of stolen that idea because they had some great graphics and things like that on their website. So I've really tried to push that as much as we can. It's a little bit tricky with our food contract because as much as we try to, you know, make the best choices that we can, there's, you know, there's other factors in the food contract that, you know, the dietitian doesn't get to have a say in. But
And can you kind of summarize, before we go deeper into that, can you kind of tell everybody a little bit about what the Go for Green program is?
Absolutely. So what they're trying to do now is actually label different foods at like a stoplight as either a green, yellow, or a red food. So our go for green, we're picking our green foods as much as we can. So what we're trying to do is pick whole, unprocessed green foods as much as we can. These are also foods that are lowest in added sugars or have no added sugar. They're going to be foods that have either healthy fats or are going to be lowest in fats, and then they're going to be highest in fiber. So that's kind of our green column if we were to, to describe all of those foods. And then our yellow and red foods are still things that we can include in our diet, right? Because we don't want to cut out anything completely, but they're not things that we want to consume in high amounts every single day. So things that are going to be higher in fats, higher in added sugars, and very processed things. So when we talk about processed foods, are things like coming in a package, man-made things like that. And it's certainly possible to find, I always try to emphasize this with soldiers too, is there's absolutely ways to find healthy processed foods, right? You can look down the cereal aisle and there's 600 options to pick from. There's a healthy cereal out there. Just because it comes in a box doesn't mean it's the worst thing. But we can also pick, maybe more healthy things. Like if you were to get just like regular oatmeal and throw some berries on it, that would be considered more of like a green food kind of option. So finding that balance between all of them, but we're trying to promote picking as many of those kind of green food, green labeled foods as we can. Our Go for Green initiative, it is very closely following a whole food plant-based, not plants only, but like a more plant predominant kind of diet. And that's a very hard transition for a lot of people. And I've been accused, several times. They said like, "Oh, well, you're a vegetarian, so that's why you're telling me to eat this way." And well, no, that's not the case. I'm, if it totally regardless of what I am eating, okay? It's our science, right? We have decades of research that say plants are, well, I shouldn't say plants, just, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts. These are the kinds of things that the majority of our diet, we have to include these foods. You can have, a serving of meat. You can absolutely choose to do that, or you could choose not to, right? But we have to still include fruits and vegetables in our diet. Like, there's no dietitian in the entire world that will say that you don't need fruits and vegetables. But I've hit that barrier several times. People have absolutely accused me of saying, you need to be vegan, you need to be vegetarian. Absolutely not the case. There is no one diet, there is no one diet plan that anyone could write out that would fit every single soldier. So we do try to kind of use that umbrella term and kind of pairing it with the Go for Green of whole food plant-based, because that's such a huge gray area in that term. Like, you can be whole food plant-based vegetarian, you can be whole food plant-based omnivore. Like, you can use that in so many different ways, and some days you're gonna have more, kind of plant foods than other days, right? There's always going to be that balance. And it's, never, there's never going to be like one day that's ever perfect. I think a lot of people get hung up on that too, but absolutely. Trying to be as evidence-based as possible in our recommendations, people will still kind of look past that. They won't always look at, okay, well, this is, their job is not to see the research. That's our job, but they will kind of look past that study and say, like, well, I'm going to keep eating meat. That's totally fine. You can absolutely still do that.
So walk us through, how you educate your soldiers on how to do that.
Absolutely. So when I'm working one-on-one with someone, I have a lot of handouts and fact sheets. That's usually my thing. So I like to try to send them off with as much material as possible so that when they're home and I'm not with them every day, because, they may not be visiting the base, they have their own lives going on during the week. So I try to kind of send them with as much written information as they can to reference. So I try to kind of keep it as simple as possible. We go over what their current nutrition looks like, average breakfast, average lunches, snacks, basically what kind of a usual eating pattern is for them, how many energy drinks they're getting in a day, things like that. And then we go through, and every time I see them, we just try to pick through a couple more things that we can improve on so that they always have at least one thing to be working on between the time that they see me in that appointment and then the next time that they come back. So kind of slow steps, they can be making healthier choices. So we're not, I try not to like write diet plans or anything like that, or like overhaul someone's mm-hmm. diet overnight, because that's usually not successful. It does work for some people, but I think for the most part, no one wants a dietitian to write them a completely new diet that I have to stick to every day for the rest of their life. That's
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's good to focus on, just like with anybody, focusing on long-term good nutrition and lifestyle changes. Because again, soldiers, they just have a history of, you know, coming into a weigh-in or a tape test. You know, they'll starve themselves for 2 or 3 days and then try to pass that height and weight test. And then on top of that, try to max their PT test, you know, and it just doesn't work that way. So I think that's, again, another barrier that has been tough for soldiers to get over, is that mentality of, I'm just going to kind of do whatever I want, what gets me through the day, and then I'm just going to starve myself. I had one soldier come in and tell me he was doing a water fast.
Oh no.
In the week before a PT test. So we had to have a little bit of a heart to heart about that and about, you know, how that's hurting him more than it's helping him. But it's tough because a lot of these soldiers too, they don't see themselves as physically active people, and they don't really have like that, I guess, athlete mindset, you could say, even though everything they do has a physical activity component to it.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. So that's the hardest thing with soldiers too, is like they don't have an off season.
Right.
You know, athletes have that off season, and they can plan, you know, okay, spring is my racing season, fall I'm leading up to that, summer I can, you know, relax a little bit more. Soldiers don't have that. You can be ready every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's very hard when I see people looking very short term rather than looking at their long term health, because that is my ultimate goal. As you know, as the dietitian for anyone, is their overall health. I'm really, as much as I'm focused on what they are eating, I want to see overall health achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. And the H2F program, it's a little bit different than, say, what you would see in like a military special operations setting, right? So I had Steve Smith do a podcast with me a couple of times, actually. I don't know if you were able to listen to it. But he came from the special operations community as their dietitian. They're a little bit higher level, right? So that the soldier athletes that you see in a special operations community, it's more about performance and getting them dialed in, right? Because they really don't have an off season. They're operational and their training tempo is just super high all the time. It seems like with the population that you and I are kind of working with, we're really focusing more on getting that good foundation built. And then we will get some soldiers who are getting ready for specialized schools who are looking maybe for more of that performance aspect and getting dialed in. But I think sometimes it can be a little bit more challenging when you're working with soldiers who have zero foundational nutrition or lifestyle, good habits built in already. So I just want to make sure that, you know, I put that out there, that it can be really similar to working just with anybody in the civilian world. But soldiers who are not in special operations, it's really difficult to get them to see that, hey, you really are a professional soldier athlete. Mm-hmm. Everything you do is based on how physically able and healthy you are, right? So if you want to get promoted, you have to pass a PT test. You have to be physically capable. If you want to go to any type of schooling, you know, you have to be physically in shape and ready to do a PT test at any given time, you know, and if they don't get promoted, they don't make more money. You know, so I have that talk with soldiers a lot. And I kind of correlate that to how their lifestyle is affecting that. And it's like this light bulb goes off in their head, because, you know, when they go into the recruiter's office, the recruiter isn't like, hey, I'm going to get you into this job and you're going to be, you know, a fit and healthy specimen and this is how you're going to do. Like, they don't talk about that. So I think a lot of soldiers, even though they know that they have to be physically in shape, Like, it doesn't really hit them until you just say it to their face.
Yeah, it is. It really is part of the job. Since you do, you have to be ready. And there's not just one piece of that. It's not just nutrition. It is the whole, kind of the whole picture.
Right. So the whole performance triad, right, is
yes.
is how the Army likes to put it. So they have, they put nutrition, physical activity, and sleep kind of as the big three that the soldier athlete really needs to focus on. And I think that's pretty accurate because I think those three are probably the ones that they struggle with the most.
Yeah.
Especially caffeine intake.
Oh, yeah. That is a really tough one.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with some of that excessiveness that is sometimes prevalent in the military community?
I really try to kind of be as evidence-based as possible because I know if someone comes in and tells you, like, hey, that's unhealthy, you shouldn't do that. Like, that's not really enough to convince you to stop whatever your habit is. So with caffeine, I try to emphasize as much as possible. Like, we have, from at least the research that we have so far, we're seeing that about 300 to 400 milligrams of caffeine in a day, like, that is kind of the cap amount that is really safe for human consumption. So I try to at least help them keep that number in mind. So if they're having multiple energy drinks a day, if they're drinking coffee throughout the day, that certainly adds up. So we always try to take a look at, what does an average day look like? Are we close to, or are we above that number? And we try to find ways to either replace or cut back on those energy drinks. And then usually what ends up happening is I sort of, prescribe some snacks throughout the day. Sometimes, I do hear back that works very well for a lot of soldiers that, if they're eating throughout the day, their uniforms have pockets everywhere. You can put so many granola bars and almonds and different things. Like, you can be prepared for this. I tell them all the time, you guys have pockets. So by, carrying around more snacks and trying to replace a lot of that and caffeine use, what we're finding is that they can really supply their body with energy in a more efficient way. Because that caffeine really is, it's sort of a Band-Aid to the problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're feeling tired throughout the day, it's because you're not giving your body energy. Or you've been awake for, more than 24 hours, something like that. Mm-hmm. There are certainly times when caffeine is necessary. I work with a lot of soldiers who work nights or work different shifts. And so, it's perfectly fine if you want to, have one on those nights or have one once in a while. Or, coffee's not a bad thing. Certainly have coffee. But it's that chronic use of, four energy drinks or something like that, like in a day, that's when we start to really look at that habit. Just because that is not our healthiest option. And also I try to tell people too that caffeine is something that, when athletes use it, they're using a specific dose for their body weight. They use it for, maybe 4, 5, 6, however many weeks of their whatever their training program is, that cycle that they're going through. And then they will cycle off caffeine because it's something that we build a tolerance to. So when I think most people can relate to this, when you, maybe start drinking coffee in college, one cup of coffee will get you through the day. If you continue that, that caffeine habit and increase, as you increase that coffee or that caffeine use with energy drinks or anything like that, your body is building a tolerance to it. So you're not quite feeling that same effect from one cup of coffee anymore. So what I do try to advise people as well is, okay, if we're going to consume caffeine, especially in these high quantities, to make sure that we're kind of cycling off of it. I'm kind of using like air quotes here, because you're giving your body a break from it, maybe 3, 4, or 5 days, from what I've read from research, is that by allowing your body to kind of take a rest from that caffeine and let your body cycle off of it, you can then come back, that next day one, and in a sense, like, use that same amount of caffeine and feel those same effects for it. So rather than, over a year's time feeling that you need more and more caffeine, by giving your body a rest, you can feel a lot better using a smaller amount of caffeine. Yeah. That sort of made sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about how we connected. I kind of want to get into this topic. So we actually met because I posted something on Instagram on my Instagram page at PerformRD about BMI and female soldier athlete performance. So the article I actually posted was from a military publication called The Ranger, and it was talking specifically about how females with a higher BMI actually perform better on a lot of the ACFT events that have to do with strength and power, and how the military maybe needs to reevaluate how they use BMI with the soldier population. So BMI has for a long time not really been an acceptable measure of an athlete's health or performance, right? So, but when we think of athletes, we think of like track people, you know, basketball people, football people, just anybody who carry maybe a higher amount of lean muscle tissue. But in the military, we're really still using BMI to determine whether or not a soldier is healthy. And so there were some questions around that. So can you kind of give us your take on how you feel about BMI and the soldier athlete and whether or not it's still relevant in that population? And then specifically about that article.
Yeah, I mean, I think BMI kind of has its place in science, right? Because wasn't it originally kind of designed to look at greater populations? So it was like epidemiology studies would use BMI to say, okay, this population has a BMI of, you know, whatever number compared to another population has this BMI. And then they would correlate it to, you know, different, you know, healthy habits or something. And so I don't think it's always the most appropriate thing to look at individuals' BMI, because again, it's not a holistic number, right? It's not taking in body fat they have and how much lean muscle that they have. So, you know, two people could, you know, have the same weight, have the same BMI, you know, any number, and still look very different and perform very differently. So I am still quite torn as to whether it's really our best number. I know it's our most practical number, right? It's very easy to put someone on a scale and measure them and say, okay, here's your BMI, you know, from a measurement standpoint and a cost-effective standpoint, it's a very easy thing to do. We can't, you know, stick every single soldier in the bod pod machine every single drill weekend. Like, we can't be doing that every drill weekend. We can certainly try. I would love to be able to do that. That would be very cool. But, you know, so it is sort of our easiest tool, but I'm not convinced that it's our best tool to be using, or our most accurate, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see, I like what you said about, you know, looking at the body fat percentage versus the lean muscle mass. So that's something that I do frequently with my soldiers as well. And that I educate them on, because they do a lot of crash dieting. And then, you know, and then when they stop dieting, you know, they end up gaining more weight. So just like with a general population, they really need to be educated on what body fat loss really looks like. So we actually have like the in-body machine in my office, and I have a bod pod accessible to me as well, just kind of across the street. But just when soldiers come into my office and they want to take a quick look, we usually use the in-body. What kind of apparatus are you guys using?
So we actually have a very cool setup. So while our H2F team was kind of originally assigned to the 293rd Battalion, they are up a few hours north of us in Fort Wayne. Our H2F team is actually located in like Camp Atterbury, which is a much bigger base that's a little bit more central to the state. And so we, our H2F team is part of like the Indiana Wellness Directive. And so we have this little Army Wellness Center where actually my office is right inside. So across the hall, we have a metabolic cart. We have two bod pod machines. We have, I'm totally spacing on the name of the RMR hood. What is that called?
Oh, the Cosmed.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Totally spacing on that name. We have to re-record that. So we do, we're able to test RMR as well. So I'm very fortunate. fortunate that we have access to all of that. So any soldier that comes to my office, we can also make them what we're calling like a health educator appointment. So we have three health educators. They're not part of our H2F team, but we work very closely with them. And they run all of our testing. So they can, soldiers have the ability to make, I think it's like an hour and a half or a 2 hour appointment with any of our health educators, and they will run them through all of the testing,
okay.
Which is a very cool thing. So then when they get to my office, I have this nice printout that says, okay, here's like the full breakdown of everything. So soldiers have that option if they want to, you know, they can come in once a month, every 3 months, every 6 months, however, you know, we feel necessary, and they can have all of that testing done, and we can have a much clearer picture of, okay, we're losing weight, but you know, some of it is fat and we're losing a little bit of muscle, or, you know, however, you know, we can see a little bit closer as to what that breakdown is, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. So the, on my side, on the active duty side, we have wellness centers who do all of that testing as well. But for our teams and our individual battalions, we actually have all that equipment available to us as well. So I have a Cosmed in my office, along with my in-body, that I'm able to use. And we can do hydration testing as well. So we actually have refractometers that we can do. Now, we haven't done any of that quite yet at my battalion because we're just not at that level.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely we have the availability to do that. So that's something else that I really love about the opportunity to work in this space is the resources available. And then also just coming out of a clinical setting, just financially, the pay is so much better.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I think...
Yeah, that is something that we really want to do is sort of have many more wellness centers throughout the state. So we have another location in Lawrence, and then we have one up at South Bend. So if we have soldiers that are closer to those areas, they can go there. But it's sort of the dream to be able to have, like, you know, 20 wellness centers or something, like, all over the state, because we could then have... We could have so much more information and data on these soldiers. It could make them, you know, it gives us just such great insight as like what is actually going on. It's so much more helpful to a soldier than to step on, you know, their bathroom scale every couple days and be like, well, who knows what's going on in there?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I want to back up a little bit because I know before we started recording, we kind of had a conversation about how, you know, you didn't necessarily go into clinical nutrition right out of internship. And a lot of dietitians feel like you have to do that mandatory stint in clinical to really move on to anything else. You know, and that's not really the path that you took. And that's not really the path that I took either. So I want to kind of talk a little bit more about that, about how you feel you should have done clinical. Are you kind of comfortable with where you've started and where you're headed? Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely. So I absolutely loved my clinical rotation in my internship. If they would have hired me as another clinical dietitian, I would have just stayed there. They have such a wonderful team at the VA. I really wanted to be part of that. But I did, when I started, even when I was in my internship, I started just kind of like browsing around, seeing kind of like what kind of jobs were available and what was out there. And most of them were looking for, you know, even what I thought looked like kind of an entry level position. They were looking for, almost all of them said 2 to 3 years clinical. Like they wanted that experience before you could apply to a lot of these jobs. So I felt like I was completely missing out by not doing that. But I really had to take a better look at kind of what my 10, 15, 20 year career, you know, was going to look like. And sort of my dream is to be able to be a college professor and to be able to teach sports nutrition. So I really had to look at what would set me up best to be able to do that down the road. And so being a sports dietitian would set me up to be able to actually teach it. So as much as I have this like little like 1% of guilt never doing those couple years of clinical, I think a lot of our job is still very clinical. You know, we're not doing tube feeds or anything like that, but a lot of what we do I think is still very clinical. So I think we're getting still kind of pieces of it. So that's how I kind of justify it in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I didn't go into clinical right away either. So when I came out of internship, I actually went into fitness and health. So I worked as a nutrition coordinator slash dietitian slash personal trainer for 3 years before I went into my next position. I don't necessarily feel like I missed out either because I really enjoyed what I did. And I knew even in internship that I didn't want to be in clinical, short term or long term. I don't regret not spending more time in clinical, because I always knew that I wanted to be in a sports nutrition setting. And having a military background, I knew that I always wanted to come back into a military setting. One, because it's unique, and just because I feel like these are my people, so this is where I want to be. I get the benefits of everything military-wise, without having to kind of deal with all the military politics. Yeah. Even though I know you haven't been a dietitian for very long, you're kind of new to the game, I still want to ask, what is something that you feel like you wish you knew, or something that you would like to kind of let other maybe new dietitians kind of coming up? What piece of advice would you give somebody who's maybe moving into or looking at moving into the same field that you're in?
I think I have sort of two pieces. So my biggest piece of advice would be to really apply for any job that you want to do. So I know, like, when I started looking at jobs, a lot of them said, you need a year's experience, you need 2 or 3 years clinical, something like that. I applied for a lot of jobs when I was coming out of my internship, and you really don't know who else is applying for that job. So it could be that no one's applying and then they have to pick you. So you really, I think I want to advise everyone not to be nervous to kind of put yourself out there, because you don't know kind of on the other side of that what they're really looking for and what they might see on your resume that might stand out to them that would make you a perfect candidate. So I think just apply for really what you really want to do and not what you think you should be doing. And then my second piece is in your first year, which I know I am still very much working on this, but really have confidence in yourself, even as a first year dietitian, that like you have the knowledge behind, all the answers that like the things that you're saying. So really have the confidence to be the dietitian, right? So I know coming into this, my very first day, they said, "Here's your office, go ahead." I was given no instructions as to what I was doing. And that first day, I remember thinking, like, maybe I should have started as like someone's assistant dietitian. Like, I remember thinking that. And I really, like, every day I've had to stop myself and really say, like, I am the dietitian. I've worked very hard to get here. And when, I do know a lot. I have 2 degrees in nutrition. I absolutely know what I'm saying. But when I don't, I'm always asking those questions. I'm always learning. I'm always finding, the next webinar, the next CEU, the next way to keep learning so that I keep up with our very quickly growing field.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are two really outstanding pieces of advice. Jenna, if people want to reach out to you or ask questions or find you on social media, how can they do that?
Okay, my Instagram is Jenna's Hungry. So they can always reach out to me there. I do get some different questions there too. I do have a website, my little side project, with different, it's a blog and it has different resources and things if anyone's looking for a little bit more information. And that is asparagusandgold.com. And then my email address is the same thing, asparagusandgold@gmail.com. You can always email me there.
Okay, awesome. And I will put that information in the show notes. And then if anybody wants to actually leave a comment or wants to record a voice message for Jenna, you can do that in the podcast as well. So you can find us on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, all the good places. And then Jenna, or if you're willing to come back and answer some of those questions, I think that would be awesome.
Yeah, I would be happy to. That'd be great.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you for being with us today, and maybe we'll talk again soon. Okay, awesome.
How do you know, man?